And everybody, thank you for coming today. I'll call this meeting to order of PFAC. It is December 13th, 2012. And the first item on our agenda is the PFAC minutes of October 11th, 2012. And does anybody have comments, corrections? Sir?
As far as committee members, I was in attendance, standing in for Bob Frank, but it doesn't identify that on the committee members.
Okay, Diane, can you make that correction, please?
Sure.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I also have a correction.
Okay.
On page 3 of the minutes, on the top of the second paragraph, it identifies the gentleman from Wells Fargo. The last name is actually Gorzeman, for the record. G-O-R-Z-E-M-A-N.
Okay. Diane, did you get that?
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments, corrections? Okay, if that's the case, and if we all agree, I'd like a motion for approval of the minutes from October 11th.
Second.
Second, and all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Nobody
Aye.
Opposed. Okay. We have the PFAC calendar for 2013, which we never ever adhere to, but
we try, right?
but I think somebody thinks this is important, so I guess we'll have a discussion about it. I see that you have scheduled this. Is it the second Thursday? Is that how you've organized it?
That's
second
correct.
Thursday of every month. Subject to change, of course. And I noted in your cover letter, there's a comment there. You say at a minimum, the PFAC shall meet on a quarterly basis. Is that a desire, a wish, or a requirement, or a regulation, or what?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's in the bylaws.
Oh, so we have to meet quarterly no matter what, whether we have an agenda or not. Okay. Okay.
Well, you could change the bylaws.
All right. May I have a motion, please, to approve the calendar for PFAC for the year 2013?
I'll move the action.
Sherry, so moved. Do we have a second, please?
I'll second.
And seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Nobody opposed. Okay. The next item on our agenda today has to do with the approval of the issuance of the short-term taxable pension obligation bonds, Series A 2013. And we, at our last meeting, we approved this in concept. And Suzanne, Ms. Lester, would you fill us in on this, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask Lewis McClure of the Public Finance staff to come to the podium to present this item.
Thank you, Suzanne. As you read, yes, item number 4 today is for the approval of the issuance of the 2013 pension obligation bonds, the short-term taxables. As you recall and mentioned, the PFAC and the board both approved this at their meetings in October. We pretty much expect to remain true to the plan that we set forth and the approval in concept. One of the bigger items being 4 to 5 fixed rate maturities, with the final maturity being no later than June 30, 2014. We also need the money in hand by January 15th, so that would be the latest that we would issue these. Let's see. As expected, and I think also mentioned in the approval in concept, some of the departments that have enough funds available actually prepay on their own and thus opt out of the financing. So our amount we're borrowing, which is maximized at 270, that would be the maximum that we would borrow, and it's probably going to be more like 268 or something like that, that amount. The other departments that finance on their own, they opt out of the financing. Let's see. Keeping that in mind, the net savings from this prepayment total would be about $19 million based on our best estimate of interest costs and the like. The finance portion, excluding those self-paying departments, is about $17.5 million of savings. I guess on December 6th and 7th, the county went up to the rating agencies and met with all three rating agencies and requested a formal rating by December 21st. And my understanding is that those meetings went well and we expect ratings on time. Is that correct?
What kind of rating do you expect?
We expect an A-plus rating, which from S&P, which we got last year. I think we expect similar to last year, although we were notified by Moody's a couple of weeks ago with 14 other counties that they are reviewing the rating status of pension bonds. So when we went up to the rating agencies, we did remind them, because the rating notice mentioned the fact that most counties are issuing pension bonds to reduce their UAAL, and we reminded them that the county is different. The unfunded accrued actuarial liability.
Right.
But the county issues these short-term notes specifically to take advantage of a discount offered by the Orange County Employee Retirement System.
Why are they, what's the concern?
The concern is a couple of the municipalities that have declared bankruptcy this past year, San Bernardino, Stockton.
Don't say Mama. We didn't.
I won't. And the fear that they may default on their debt. I think, and I'd have to double check, but I think there's at least one that has stopped making their contributions to CalPERS. So there's, you know, an uncertainty in the air and a fear that that type of behavior is going to spread.
Does Proposition 30 have anything to do with this? I mean, does that have an impact on it?
Not that I'm aware of.
There's no collateral spinoff from that? Okay.
Not that we've heard.
This is why Moody is reviewing it?
Yes, and we requested the rating from all three rating agencies, but a couple of weeks earlier, Moody's had sent us a notice of review, the County of Orange and 14 other counties.
Chair, may I
ask
a question? On the rating agencies, how many are really required to have a successful marketing?
I guess I would answer, and I'll look back also at our consultants, and as many as needed.
Would two suffice?
Last year we got two, but because of the increased anxiety, it seems like, in the market over pension bonds, it was recommended that we go to all three.
Hi. David Broadsley with KNN, the financial advisor. That's exactly correct. The only other thing is Fitch also rates you a little higher than S&P does, so you would get two ratings in the AA category with the addition of a Fitch rating. So the underwriter had recommended, and we concurred, that in this instance, the third rating would add value greater than the cost of a rating fee.
So is it very common to go to that many rating agencies, and do you go to more than three? To gauge where they might come out?
No, not really. There's really three majors. There are a couple that are kind of emerging and
right.
For specialty markets. But it's not uncommon for large issuers to get three ratings. And it's not uncommon for smaller issuers to get one ratings. It's a little bit as much art as science in making that decision.
Yeah.
But in this case, it seemed like three was appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, we may want to revisit that. We may want to understand where people are coming out, and if someone is going to change their methodology on the eve or getting a rating, and we think, and that change may not be something we agree with or is market tested, we should probably know that prior to committing to three rating agencies.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you at all. the timing here happened to be sort of in the middle of it. And ironically, even with, if Moody's takes a tougher view on POBs, they still will rate your POBs higher than S&P will. So from a market impact, you won't be harmed. It's just Moody's used to rate POBs higher than lease debt, and now they're thinking of lowering it down. S&P currently rates POBs and lease debt at the same rating. So, but it's absolutely appropriate to have a conversation about this. We do as a financing team all the time in terms of what the appropriate rating strategy is.
May I continue a little bit? Yeah. Also wanted to explore two things that you touched on. One on the discount. When was that negotiated, and are there any thoughts to opening that back up?
The OSER, the Orange County Employee Retirement System, approved at their August meeting, and they go through this annually, evaluate and vote to determine if they're going to offer a discount to plan sponsors. And the county was offered 7.75%, which is OSER's assumed rate of investment return.
Okay, have there been any discussions to, because there is a history of other kinds of discounts than just the actuarial rate being negotiated?
I'm not aware of other discounts, but no, the county has not negotiated. We've accepted the offer.
It's in the news this week that the OSERS is lowering the yield to 7.5 or 7.25, which is it?
It's 7.25 phased in over 2 years. So the first fiscal year that will be effective, 7.5% will be effective starting fiscal year 14-15. And then the 7.25 will be effective July, beginning fiscal year 15-16.
Which will increase our obligation.
Correct.
The county's obligation. Yeah. What is the, can you give us a brief history of OSER's actual yields that they've experienced the last couple of years?
Yes. Well, to date, as of the end of October, year to date, 9.64%. And OSERS is on their fiscal year is a calendar year. So their year end is December 31st. So 2011 was 0.74%.
So they broke even last year.
Right. And
No,
0.74%.
0.74, less than 1%.
Correct.
Yes. Right. Okay. So they essentially broke even.
Right. When you said broke even, I was thinking they made their actuarial rate, but it's.
They didn't. They basically were flat. Yes.
And then going a couple years back, 2010 was 11.7%. 2009, 18.52%. And then, of course, 2008, which was a nasty year for most, negative 20.71%.
Okay.
I have one final question on the opt out. Are the folks that are opting out, are they receiving a benefit relative to the financing that we're doing?
They're not participating in the financing because they're using their own resources, so they're receiving the full discount, but they are not sharing in any cost of financing.
They actually get a better deal because they're not paying interest, a portion of the interest or cost of issuance, so they're actually getting the full discount.
Right, because they're doing it out of their own treasury, right? Got it.
So these are, you know, our enterprise funds, airport, OC waste management, our OC parks, a couple other non-general fund.
Okay. Ms. Friedrich, do you have any comments?
No, I was just going to say if there were questions, I do sit on the OSERS board, and Suzanne mentioned, we did make a decision to offer the discount rate at the 7.75. That was back in August at the meeting last month. As you mentioned, we did drop the discount rate to 7.25. It's really based on a couple of factors. You have to look at the details of it, and then obviously the rate drops out of that. There were some factors that went up and some factors that went down from last year. And it did come up at one of our board meetings that we will be looking to see, do we change that discount rate? But I think the thought from, I can't remember what board member it was, is that we wouldn't offer maybe the whole rate. It might be something less, so it would probably be a not as much of a discount, because of course when you pay the money in, you aren't earning 7.75 on average for that, you know, starting that period. You might get a good month, you might get a bad month, so it just depends on the timing of those payments. Obviously we have a process of putting that money to work, and we do plan generally by talking to the plan sponsors on who they expect how much money to come in. But it is something that of course is you know, coming in at a specific time, and you have to see where the market is to a little bit as you deposit those funds and invest those. But I'd be available for any additional questions if you need anything. I also provided my information. Actually, I've got it to get to Suzanne by tomorrow. We had our due diligence meeting with the advisors and bond counsel, and there were several items, not material, that I will provide to Suzanne on the detail of the packet. But thank you.
Okay. Mr. Rodiker, do you have any comments?
Just a couple. A question, really. You said they're reducing the number from 7.75 to 7.25?
Correct.
How often is that reviewed?
Yearly.
Every year?
I might answer because I sit on the board. Generally, we review the actuarial information every 3 years. However, last year was the third year, was the year we were to review it. We were changing our asset allocation, which is probably one of the largest pieces for it. And so last year, the board voted to keep the rate the same and then review it in a one-year period. We also changed our consultant, so there were a couple of factors going in. And there was a motion to actually reduce it to 7.5 last year that did fail. And then this year, again, we're out of sequence, so we will be reviewing it in another 2 years. But it is something that if we feel there is a significant change, the board could move to review it earlier. In fact, we just got a report from an actuary who audits our current actuary, and they had indicated some of the changes that they recommended that our actuary make. That was at our audit committee meeting. That will go to the full board, and then we'll go to the plan sponsors. Nothing significantly different than what changes were made at the meeting last month, which they thought the rate would be lowered. So we do review it every 3 years. Thank you.
That does seem like a smart move to reduce it to 7.2, but just my observation, the five-year average of those numbers you gave me is 4%. So if we're earning 4 and we're promising 7.25, am I missing something?
No.
Okay.
if you fall short, we have to make it up the following year. Is that right? I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Well, I think Sherry can back me up, but gains and losses are amortized over 5 years, right?
Okay.
So we invest the money, and if we don't hit the rate of return, then there's a layer put on the future rate structure that adjusts for gains and losses in the retirement system.
So
it's smoothed out. It's not year by year.
Okay.
And I think just the only other item is, as the actuary would say, this is a long-term rate, so you really are not looking at the short-term volatility in the market, and you don't want to, obviously, our goal is to strive to hit 7 points, you know, in this case, 2.5 now that we've dropped it, but we know that is not going to happen every year because you just don't have that capability. What we do is break it down into pieces. We look at what the inflation is expected to be. Then you look at what the real return on the assets is expected to be. You look at what the expenses are. And then we have a factor for confidence that we would meet that our actuary works with us. And so those factors then add up to come down to that 7.25. And I think our real rate on return that was in the calculation was 4.94%. Again, that was excluding any inflation. And as you know, because there is inflation, but on that, and inflation has been certainly fairly low, lower than probably the historical average these last several years. So that is another factor that looks at it, but you really look at it over a long-term 30-year period on it. There are, we were one of the few pension plans that made a half a percentage point change. Most pension plans, it looked like we're making a 0.25% change. And you also have to consider the impact on the plan sponsors, because if you make such dramatic changes, again, they're all estimates, you then create a lot more volatility in the system. And certainly, you know, there were some board members that were thinking perhaps it should go lower, but I think in looking at all the facts, our actuary, who really understands these very, very clearly, really recommended either a 7.5 or a 7.25 recommendation.
Ms. Grimes, you have something?
No.
Any comments? Mr. Kemp, you have some comments?
No.
All right. If that being the case, I think we should go for $17 million savings on this. If that's the case, I would like to ask a motion for approval. Do we have a second, please?
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And anybody opposed? The taxable pension obligation bonds 2013 Series A is approved by PFAC. I believe we have a presentation by Feldman Rollup. Is that correct?
That's correct.
This falls into the teaching section of our meeting.
We're going to have a presentation today on revenue bonds presented by Tom DeMars and Dan Wiles from Feldman Rollup.
Excuse me. Before you do that, can I just make one more comment for the minutes on this? In this, PFAC was submitted, I think my computer said 178 pages of documents related to this. The resolution, the bond purchase agreement, the official statement, the third supplemental trust agreement, the pension obligation indenture, and the continuing disclosure. I have to ask the question, as the public finance department and the county council reviewed these, and are you satisfied that they're in good order?
Yes, sir. The financing team, including county council, public CEO, public finance, bond counsel, financial advisor, underwriter has reviewed these, and except for some minor changes, such as Ms. Friedenrich mentioned, we had due diligence meetings with all five board members last week, and then we had a due diligence meeting with the public officials, including the treasurer, tax collector, auditor, controller, county council, and CEO and CFO, who had reviewed the POS, the preliminary official statement, and gave some feedback on some minor changes, but substantially in good order.
All right, I just wanted to bring that up so that you weren't relying on the members of PFAC to study and approve these 178-page documents.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
All right, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hammond and other members of the committee. My name is Tom DeMars, and I'm the managing partner principal of Feldman Rollup. And I've been the main consultant from the firm that's been representing or serving the county in the financial advisory capacity for, 20-plus years. And I know you've had a number of things that have come before you that have been termed as notes or bonds, or whether they be assessment districts or Mellow Roofs or teeter bonds or pension bonds, and know that you've had a schedule this past year of some training and some education that the Public Finance Department had wanted to provide the committee over time. And I'm not sure how many of those actually occurred. Some of them have been canceled. But today we want to focus on a very basic subject of what is the bond, specifically more, what is a revenue bond. I want to introduce my business partner, Dan Wiles, who's been with the firm since 1999. and has been in the business for over 25 plus years, and has had a former life as a bond counsel, in fact, and has his training as an attorney. He also serves on the board of, as in the Child Abuse Prevention Center here in Orange County, which has a lot of activity with the county itself. So I'd like to turn it over to Dan and have him do the main part of the presentation, and then we'll be available to answer questions during the presentation or subsequent to that. And we'll be able to identify some things that the county has done in the past that relate to revenue bonds in and of themselves. Okay?
Dan. Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity on behalf of Fieldman and myself. I would like to be as informal as we can, given we've got a dais and a microphone and the whole thing. This is a very, very basic curriculum. If you've paged through it, for those of you who've been through revenue bond financing, you may look at this and go, so I've seen this before. Our desire is really to start from fundamentals. And we're here to answer questions, to talk about specific circumstances if you want, you know, to the extent that that's fair and ethical to do so. So we can just start, we're going to start with, like I said, with the very foundations of what's a bond? What is it literally at law? What is it in practice? It's your obligation to pay money. And it's your obligation to pay money, particularly when you start talking about revenue bonds, but it's your obligation to pay money from either a general fund, which is things like the pension obligation bonds. That's a general obligation. It's a general fund obligation, sorry. I want to be careful to not veer too much into terms of art. It's a general fund obligation. You can pay it from any money you have on hand. Or you can pay it from a specific source, and we'll talk about that with revenue bonds. So it's an obligation to pay a stated amount of money, the principal. That's what you borrowed, with some mathematical modification for wonderful bond concepts like coupon and yield and premium and discount. But generally, a bond in and of itself, the face of a bond says, Orange County, will pay you, whoever you is, $5,000 on July 1, 2019, or some date. At a given time, the maturity, at a stated amount of interest. Can either be over a period, it can be at some notes, it can be paid at the very end, or with what you call zero coupon bonds, it can be paid at maturity, which can be many years in the future, where it simply compounds over that entire period, and there's no payment in the middle. Who can issue? We list here cities, counties like you, special districts, school districts. The IRS phrase is political subdivisions. States and political subdivisions can issue bonds of different types and can have the interest on those bonds exempt from federal income tax at least through 2012. We will see what comes up in 2013. That is an entirely different educational topic. Revenue bonds and bonds in particular are intended to be marketable securities. That is, they're intended to be able to be traded freely. And in order for them to be traded freely, they need to become commoditized to some degree. That is, when you look at it, one bond needs to look a lot like another. That is, there need to be some structures in common. You need to be in a situation where you can say, oh, I know what I basically know what I'm getting. And the more you have to, there's a story behind it. We call that in the business a story bond. The more that there's a story, the less marketable it becomes, the less liquid it becomes. And the term, when you deal with underwriters, if the people from J.P. Morgan were still here, because I think Melissa has left, they would use the term liquidity. Buyers like liquidity. Good ratings, simple structure. The more those things are easily understood and well accepted, the more tradable a bond is, the more liquid it becomes. So let's talk about revenue bonds. So we talked about what bonds are themselves. Now, revenue bonds are just simply bonds that are payable from a defined revenue source, from a very specific revenue source. A discrete source, which is not general fund. Now, I will say, in California, we do want to make this exception. There are lease revenue bonds in California that the county issues and political subdivisions issue. They are payable from general revenues, often, usually. There are some exceptions, but those are the exceptions. We refer to those briefly, but that's not, when we think of revenue bonds, that's not really what we're thinking about. We're thinking about a political subdivision that has a stream of revenue that goes on off into the future that says, I have things I need to pay for today, and I don't have the money today to pay for them. But they are improvements, capital improvements, that will have a life that goes over many years. Therefore, I want to charge against this revenue stream for the life of this asset, or something that approaches the life of this asset. I want to charge against this revenue stream a debt service so I can bid the asset today. As opposed to the other way around, where you'd have to accumulate in a sinking fund years and years and years until you could finally buy the asset, and then you go without it until you get there. It could be an efficient way to do things, but frankly, you'd be playing catch up. You know, as a government, you would be playing catch up continually. So the market has developed that you can issue revenue bonds, so you can, to use a legal term back from my earlier days, and Tom was wrong, by the way, it was not 25 years. I am older than I look, and it is 30 years. I graduated from the University of Minnesota Law School in 1982, and have been a public finance advisor for almost 25 years. So examples of revenue sources, and often they're self-sustaining enterprise funds. You look at things, you know, the county has an airport. The county has a certain amount of harbor bonds, although that's Little Harbor, as opposed to like Port of LA and Port of Long Beach. They're golf course bonds, toll revenue bonds, the TCA system. One of our largest clients is Riverside County Transportation, which is doing the extension of the express lanes into Riverside County for the low price of about $1.3 billion. You can have revenue bonds that are tax and special fee, or, you know, or special tax or other fee revenue bonds that are not from an operating entity per se, but they're a much more passive kind of tax collection. You're not doing things to generate the money. You are simply like an income tax, a sales tax. You are taxing events that occur outside of your control. And that has a little bit of an impact as to the credit quality, because you don't have any control over, you know, a sales tax. You simply put a rate on, and the tax you collect is the tax you collect. So it isn't like charging for water or sewer, where you can look in the middle of a year and say, I'm behind. I need to raise more money. Therefore, I can increase rates in order to raise more money. It's a passive tax. Let's go to the next page. So this is where we're going to hit this quickly, because it's the legalities, and most people get incredibly bored by them. If you start from the very basics in California, you have a constitutional requirement of 2/3 vote for debt. For the case of revenue bonds, that's not applicable. It's not applicable. First reason it's not applicable is because there's generally what's called a special fund exception. That is, that you are raising money from a particular source of revenue. You are limiting the payment to that source of revenue. Because it's not generally payable from general funds of the community, it is not subject to the 2/3 vote requirement. That does not mean that it's not subject to other requirements. So the state has an act, the 1941 Revenue Bond Act, which allows revenue bonds, but is actually hardly ever used itself, because it has a majority vote requirement, which most people don't want to take either. So what happens is that you either have a statutory exemption for many types of revenue bonds, or you do a lease or a kind of a quasi-lease structure where you actually pledge revenues, but it's a lease structure, and under the Marx-Ruess Act, you can use a joint powers authority, and that will allow you to issue revenue bonds without a vote, either the 2/3 constitutional vote or the 50% 1941 Act vote.
Excuse me, can you do lease revenue bonds tax exempt?
Yes.
You can.
Yes, you can. The There are a lot of standards in the Internal Revenue Code for what is tax exempt, but primarily if it's for a governmental subdivision, political subdivision, and it's for, particularly if it's for capital improvements, by and large, you can find a way to do those with a bond that the interest is exempt from income tax.
And the county has used that Mark's Roost Act quite often under the South Orange County Public Financing Authority, if you remember those. Yeah. That would be considered revenue bonds under that Mark's Roost Act.
Let me just take a gauge here. Are you getting new information, or are you just sitting there going, God, I know all this stuff?
That's very interesting.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to, we don't want to be wasting a lot of your time here. Go through some basic terms. You can have a maximum rate under the 1941 Act of 12%. Lately, obviously, that's irrelevant because market rates are nowhere near that. It becomes relevant when you negotiate with a bank. When you negotiate things like when the county has a liquidity facility of some sort, there's often a default rate. The default rate is intended to be as penal as possible. So they push that up to the maximum rate. And we'll want often more than 12%. And we'll have provisions to try to get more than the legally, at any one time, the legally maximum rate. But under current market provisions, we're in the territory of 12%. But it's not that long ago. I mean, for those who were in business in the 1980s, you routinely saw tax exempt rates that were 10 plus. So, what's old can be new again. That can happen. The term of bonds under the 41 Act is a maximum of 40 years. Other statutes can have different limitations as to maturity. 40 years is really, it's not the maximum bonds can be sold in the market. The practical maximum tends to be 30 years. That's where a long-term bond, that's where they generally tend to be. 40 years, again, at law in the 41 Act. Now, there are some instances, and the University of California did this, where they fundamentally sold what was called a century bond, and they went out 100 years. And Peter Taylor, the CFO of the University of California, said, well, it was like selling shares of stock. I mean, it was fundamentally like equity, and it was very cheap. And so we have all this money that we did it on a taxable basis because it's not tied to the life of an asset. Again, the Internal Revenue Code provisions would not allow you to do that tax exempt because it's just simply more than 125% of the life of the assets. But they borrowed in the taxable market, and they have a pool of cash that will enable them to cushion some problems in operations. It will enable them to take some opportunities. But those bonds literally are payable. I believe it's 2011, I believe those bonds are payable. And Walt Disney has done the same kind of thing as well in the private market. You could finance a whole list of things. By and large, if it's capital, you can finance it. Now, this is, I think, Tom, you had added this. This is a specific list from California state law. I think this is a...
Yeah, from the CDAC.
Yeah. Okay, it's from CDAC's public finance primer. Generally, when you're talking about revenue bonds, you are looking for a nexus. That is, if you're going to use a revenue, it's a revenue that has something to do with the improvements. Generally, there are some exceptions, but for the most part. So the example we have here, sewer charges for sewer facilities, normal, all the districts do it. It's how you do financing. It's how you do capital improvements if you run a special district. Sewer charges for a municipal parking garage, more problematic. You may be able to find a way to do it. We like to be as clever as possible, and we do have clients that sometimes have very specific problematic needs, and they try to do that. But in general, that's not something you can do.
Are there other common examples of controversial revenue bonds that you can point to?
Oh, controversial? You mean controversial in that way?
In the way that they may not qualify as a revenue bond, but municipalities have explored it.
I'm trying to think of real estate. Yeah, that could be, you end up with, it's analogous. City of San Diego, originally to finance Petco Park, the City of San Diego use stadium revenues and some other revenues, and at the dying of redevelopment, entered into a deal with the redevelopment agency where the redevelopment agency would take the tax increment and would make payments to the stadium, I think stadium authority or the city, to pay those bonds. That's the kind of off the top of my head, that's the one that rings to mind. So if you're going to have bonds payable from revenues, you've got to define what your revenues are. This is getting a little bit more into the details, but there are two fundamental ways to define what revenues are. One is what's happened in the past, historically. What have your revenues been? Particularly if you have an ongoing revenue source, you can look back over the last few years and say, how have we done? That's a good indicator of how we will do in the future. If you don't have a historical set of revenues, for example, if you, again, are the folks in Riverside County who are going to build an extension of express lanes, and you've never raised a dime before doing that, then you hire a feasibility consultant who gives you a detailed study of what the revenues will be. And it's a much more complex process when you do that. And there are feasibility consultants for things like toll revenues. There are feasibility consultants for water, sewer revenues, for electric revenues. All sorts of revenues you can find consultants. Now, there is an old saying that says there are very few infeasibility consultants. So this, which is really just a take it with a grain of salt, do some analysis with it. In a modern rating setting, when you walk in with a feasibility study, with a particularly toll revenues, a traffic and earnings report, you will take a trip through the looking glass and tear those numbers to pieces and go down to the economic fundamentals and do stress testing on those. And there, I wouldn't want to present the impression that it's simply a consultant walks in, here's my set of revenues, they give it a blessing, and off we go. No questions asked. As credit has become more and more of an issue, those numbers get more and more scrutiny. The credit quality is influenced by those numbers because the question is, because you're estimating a revenue that can go up or down, and it often can go up or down regardless of what you do. You have no control. You have maybe influence, but no control. Even if you control a rate, you only have influence on the amount of money you can take in. Because, an example of TCAs, there's only so high you can raise toll rates. And people will say, I'm not going to use the 241 tollway. I'm going to go down El Toro and go to the 5. So there's only so much money you can raise. So you have to build into a revenue bond structure an ability to absorb variance. We call that coverage. So the ability to absorb variance is the fact that you have estimated, you've sized your debt on the idea that the debt service doesn't take all the revenue you're expecting. That in any given year, you expect that there will be more revenues than there are debt service. So therefore, if your revenues are lower, you can still pay your debt service. That's coverage. And often when we talk about, if we talk about things like water and sewer, we talk about 115%, 125%. If we talk about toll revenue bonds, we talk about 150%, 130%. If we talk about sales tax, we talk about 150%. Better credit quality is 200%. That's what we're talking about, is the relationship between the revenues you expect in any given year and the amount of debt service you're going to have to pay. With the idea being that, remember, bond buyers, go back to the definition of a bond. A bond is a fixed obligation to pay principal and interest. Bond buyers are not equity buyers. They're not interested in waiting. If you have a bond that's due June 1 of 2019, when June 1 rolls around, where's my money? Because they want it now. It has to be there now. So that's why you have coverage, in order to make sure that you have or at least to provide more assurance that when that fixed date comes where either principal or interest are due, that you're going to have the money to pay them. So that's why, that's why coverage is important. And it's just intuitive. The higher the ratio, And the more you agree that you'll maintain a ratio, the better your credit quality will be for any given type of revenue. So what kind of security do you get? Well, most of the discussion we've had has been around enterprise revenues. So that's cash flow security. So this isn't, while it's like a home mortgage, it's not a home mortgage in the sense that if Tom is advising on a water revenue bond, there is no claim on a hard fixed asset. There is a claim on a stream of revenue that comes in. You can, as money comes in, if you're a bondholder, you have a right to take money out of that stream of revenue, generally after you pay the operation and maintenance. We'll talk about that in just a second. So that's an enterprise pledged revenue. When you have a lease interest, it's different because really that's a quasi, that's a general fund obligation. You do get asset security because, in fact, under California law, that's how you can pay your lease. You pay a lease under California law because you have beneficial use of a facility. And we do structures in a lease transaction that make sure that either make sure you have beneficial use of the facility or you ensure the fact if you have an earthquake or you have specific damage, you have business interruption insurance that pays while you don't have beneficial use, because under the Constitution of California, you can't pay. I mean, you simply can't pay on a lease revenue debt if you don't have access to the facility.
The toll road controversy that seems to be in the news all the time, is that a revenue pledge bond or are those lease interest bonds?
Revenue pledge. Those are a revenue pledge.
So the bondholders can never own the toll roads?
Bondholders do not own the toll roads themselves.
They'll never be able to own them.
Nope. ultimately, I believe it's Caltrans that'll own them. I mean, once, assuming everything gets paid off someday, someday in the future, Caltrans will own those toll roads. Right now, they're owned by the TCA, have a maintenance agreement with Caltrans.
Can you speak to the impact on the credit for the county when you have failed revenue bonds? Where there's no direct obligation, but there's a reputational hit, because there's a bit of a perverse incentive to go out and maximize the financing on revenue bonds, and we always talk about how to do that, but we don't talk about sort of the flip side is if they fail or something goes wrong, how that might affect the county. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Let's talk at some points on the spectrum. That is. We haven't talked about conduit revenue bonds, but let me hit that really, really quickly. You've had, I'm sure, hospitals come through and say, we want to borrow tax exempt, therefore the county's going to issue bonds for us, mm-hmm. and you get the IRS tax exemption. That is on the farthest end of the spectrum. That is, if for some reason CHOC doesn't make their payments, you can really say, well, we tried. We were good corporate citizens. We were good citizens, and we helped them out, and that really has no reputational impact, because you have no, the reputational impact is directly proportional, frankly, to the amount of influence you have. But I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example from today. Mm-hmm. City of San Bernardino has filed their Chapter 9, and they're the people that you're talking about who aren't paying CalPERS, they've decided not to pay CalPERS. So they're causing all these other problems. San Bernardino County literally sends out notices that says, we are not the city of San Bernardino. We are different. Because there's a trading differential between San Bernardino County and Riverside County. And there's no fundamental reason, there's no financial reason why there would be any significant trading differential. In fact, before bankruptcy, there wasn't a trading differential. It's purely reputational at that point. That's a little irrational, because there really isn't any reason for it. So that's in a sense the other end of the spectrum. I don't know if I'm helping you in terms of being able to evaluate any specific situation, but it really is the more you have the more it's involved or close to a governmental project, the more concern you need to have that your name is associated with it, and therefore it reflects on your management from a substantive point of view. That's, I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb.
And it can rise to the level of materiality, you know, if you have these, you know, a problem with a revenue bond, and that's what we need to be thinking about all the time is we just approve these things, and a lot of our throwaway answer is sort of, well, it's not a GO, so yeah, but I think we need to think about that.
Yeah, and typically in those situations, like Dan said, the more closely the organization is related to that specific issue, there's a higher risk component involved. So there's typically higher interest rates. But one of the things that agencies try to do, and we typically advise them to do, is that you put on belts and suspenders. Okay, so you put on additional security for additional a revenue pledge or an asset pledge or something else that enhances the ability for that entity to be able to pay, whether it's through a sale of an asset or through some other revenue stream that would backstop the original enterprise fund, let's say, that was pledged. So you try to add things on that would be considered a more risky type of security by adding additional securities to it.
So could a way of maybe thinking through that issue quantitatively is doing revenue bonds with higher credit ratings? That
yes.
would be reflective
yeah. well, yes.
of enhanced collateral or you know, greater coverage ratios or whatever's
exactly.
driving that. Could that
right.
be a practical way
right.
of
So
of
if you're wanting higher credit ratings, then you have to build in these better security measures or coverage measures or revenues that will assure the rating agencies that you will have a higher credit rating, which will reduce the borrowing costs.
I have a question about if these Mark's Roost bonds, and Orange County has a pile of them, and they're lease interest bonds, and what would be the mechanism, and there have been a couple of Mark's Roost fails in California, I mean, I think two, if I'm not mistaken. And what would be the mechanism for the bondholders to grab the assets?
Sometimes it depends on the documentation. And lately the underwriting firms have been more resolute in wanting the direct ability of a trustee to walk in and relet the property.
So they could go in and buy the streets and the fire station and everything else?
You know, fundamentally when lease bonds were first used, the primary thing wasn't so much that the property could be reused by somebody else, but that it couldn't be used by you. So in a lease bond, so you'd say, well, I've got City Hall under a lease, and it's really essential to me as the city. It's really essential, and therefore I will pay, because if I don't pay, I can't use City Hall anymore. So that was the first, you know, sort of the first level was this idea that it's really essential and I can't have access to it. But as the issue's gotten more sensitive over time, now we're getting into a situation, particularly where you're talking about a building or, you know, facility particularly.
Or empty land.
Or empty land, where the trustee, where the underwriter will want the trustee to have the power to step in and release the property to another party to generate income, to actively generate other income. And like I say, it used to be that there wasn't as much attention paid to those kinds of provisions, but there is now.
Well, do you have any knowledge? I know that there has been two fairs. I can't remember where they were in California on these things, and the developer sold the bonds, and he never, he improved the streets and so on, but he never sold the property, and they failed. And so are you familiar with that? How did that work out?
Yeah, Tom. They were probably more on the Mello Roos bonds, and then they were pooled with these joint powers authorities that didn't have that geographical nexus.
Yeah,
which the law got changed after all those bonds went into default. So the legislation was changed that there had to be a geographical nexus to be able to have a joint powers authority together. So you couldn't have an agency in Southern California and one in Yolo County and trying to issue bonds in Elk Grove, California, out of Sacramento. So that got changed, but ultimately they end up getting worked out through either the bank that the mortgage or the developer would have his loan on or the title to it. So they ultimately get worked out. But it's mainly in the land-based Melrose Assessment District arena that happens.
Well, it's interesting because we had, I guess, were they Marks Roos or Mello Roos that the Irvine Company had in Newport Coast?
Right.
Were they Marks Roos or Mello? Were they Mello Roos?
Well, it was an assessment district similar to a Mello Roos district.
Yeah, well, what happened was for whatever reason, their own reasons, they never developed all this land. And the Irvine Company being the Irvine Company, they just bought the bonds back. But assuming it wasn't the Irvine Company and they couldn't, you know, the builder couldn't afford to buy them back, you know, what would be the mechanism? And you, as you say, it's just, you just slug it out and work it out.
I mean, right, and there's actual foreclosure, accelerated foreclosure proceedings within those particular transactions that you can do, rather than waiting the five-year period for the treasurer tax collector to be able to foreclose.
So you start that process.
So
you can foreclose, yes, theoretically, on these.
Right, and typically what has happened most recently in the real estate downtrend that we've been experiencing is that those that have been in trouble, the banks have stepped in and made sure that those payments are being made rather than going through the foreclosure process, for which would amount to a small portion of what the total property tax bill is.
Yeah, I understand.
So there's an incentive for the banks to keep paying.
So it's a mucky workout is what it amounts to.
Right. But when you're dealing with a high, you know, a high grade credit of a single A or double A or better, you typically don't run into those types of situations. Yeah. It's usually in the land development case.
The land development.
And your favorite subject of the mortgage revenue bonds.
Right. Yes.
So what now in terms of the entities that qualify to to sign the leases for these, has that evolved at all?
It hasn't really been limited, per se. I mean, the ability to lease comes from, the ability to
the,
sign
the,
a lease
the
comes from
aren't
them.
That important, right? They don't need to be that creditworthy because they're a general obligation anyway. Is that sort of the, they're sort of entities that are not that important because of that?
Two different issues. One is legally what you can do. The other is what's the value of it.
Right.
Legally, what you can do, anybody can do it. Any entity that has the power to own real estate and to use real estate has this power to sign a lease and to therefore enter into a lease for real property. Next question is, if you do that, can you actually take that stream of revenue and sell it, and will anybody buy it? And that is a different question, because that's where you get into these credit rating issues that you were talking about. And it's, I will say, we are, for a general government purpose, we are usually in a situation, taking away 2008, liquidity crisis, take away that, generally it's a matter of price. You can get it sold. The question is, what will you have to pay? And there, depending on market conditions, we call it credit spread. It can be more or less of a differential from a AAA down to a very small community. Now, you know, here in Orange County, most of the cities are, you know, I think half the cities are AAA, are natural AAAs, and then their lease revenue bonds are AA+.
Right.
So you don't see an awful lot of
that. But that's because there's some agency entity on the lease, but the county is really backing it. So I guess the question would be, is there a strategy, is there a way to do lease revenue bonds in the county that don't require that obligation, and how far wide do those price?
Well, I'm not certain. Like, give you an example. We work for the City of Rancho Santa Margarita. That's where I live. They just refinanced City Hall. They're a AA+. Their lease obligation is to pay for City Hall. If they don't pay, they can be excluded from the use of City Hall. We really didn't, because of the high credit quality, we did not.
Is the city just the lessee?
Yeah, city's
no
less.
Other entity. Okay.
Well, there's a. It's a. It's done as a. It's done. You know, under a Mark's Roost structure, so there's an authority, but it's just a. It's a fictional entity.
Right. Right.
So there is nobody else. So that's why I don't want to be argumentative, but the county is only on the hook to the extent that you say the county's on the hook if you have some recourse to individual real property. The county isn't really involved in that transaction per se. Because it really is the city's, city's obligation to pay it. If the city can't pay it, it takes the trustee can take the property and deal with the property in whichever way it sees fit. And so I don't know if the county's really involved there per se. And frankly, if the city of Rancho Santa Margarita didn't pay, that would have very little impact on the county. Mm-hmm. Just wouldn't, it wouldn't really be
right,
a reputational impact.
Right, the county, obviously, not the city, right?
Yeah. Did I respond to your question? Or
yes.
Am I gonna? Okay,
yes.
I just want to make sure. Let me just pick up. We talked about coverage. There's one other element that is often and traditionally has been a part of a revenue bond, and that is a debt service reserve fund. That's a pool of cash. It's usually funded from the bond proceeds. The IRS says there's only so much you can collect. A vestige of the days when you could actually borrow money tax exempt and invest it for more than what you cost. So the IRS said it has to be the lesser of, we talk about the lesser of three, 10% of the par amount of the bonds, the maximum annual debt service, or 125% of the average annual debt service. And that's for bond debt service that goes up and down and up and down and up and down. So 125% of average is a more accurate measurement. Gross revenues versus net revenues, make this really quick, because we are taking a while. There is a thought that gross revenue versus net revenue is basically where do bondholders get to stick their hand in the stream of funds to get paid. Do they get paid before operation and maintenance costs, or do they get paid after operation and maintenance costs? In many respects, the rating agency will tell you they don't really care. Because if it's a long-term financing, year 25, if you haven't been paying operation and maintenance costs for years 1 through 25, there's a real problem. So the fact that the revenues may be enough to pay debt service but aren't enough to pay operation and maintenance is a, it's not going to be creditworthy. And no good bondholder would want that bond. So whether you provide a gross pledge or a net pledge doesn't really matter. When we do talk about net revenues, we talk about this on a cash basis. That is, revenues that come in as gross, you pay your operation and maintenance costs. On an accounting basis, operation and maintenance costs would include a non-cash item of depreciation or amortization. It does not, in terms of when we talk bond net revenues, it doesn't include that. Because you may be reserving depreciation, but you still got the cash. And bondholders care about whether you've got the cash. So that's why we say O&M, less, not including depreciation. The idea of a rate covenant. This is where you have the ability to change rates. This is where you can say, this is like water and sewer, electricity, parking, where you could say, okay, I'm not doing as well this year, and so therefore I'm going to push rates up. And often it is to that same kind of target that you have in order to be, that you've structured the bonds around. I have bonds that are structured at 1.50 or 150% coverage. Therefore, I will covenant with the bondholders that I will set my rates and charges such that it will each year collect 150%. And if I fall behind in a year, I will raise them. And if I fall behind and I can't get them raised up, then I will make an agreement that we're going to bring in a management consultant and we're going to do a whole bunch of things to try avoid crashing the deal. And you run into, we say on the page, it assumes you have control of the revenues. Where it's a sales tax, that's a passive revenue source, and you don't have control of the revenues. And then even for utilities, there are unstated Prop 218 issues that, whether you can actually make an agreement that you will raise rates in the future.
Excuse me, what's 218?
Oh, Proposition 218. Tom may be able to describe it better than I can. But
it was done in, 96, I believe, which requires utilities, particularly for water and sewer, to rather than just raise the water and sewer charges that they might have, that they actually have to hold a public hearing and be able to have a protest hearing to be able to raise them before they actually do now. So there's actually a process that they have to go through before just raising them.
So that could impact. If you've made an agreement that says, I'm going to maintain this amount of coverage, and you're not maintaining it, and therefore you have a legal obligation that says, I'm going to raise rates, but you have a legal obligation that says, before I raise rates, I'm going to have a hearing, and I'm going to have notice and a hearing and a right to protest, you can get into a position where they're in conflict. We've not had that happen yet in California because nobody has truly fought it out. But there is no answer yet, legally, as to what happens if you do fight it out. Got one? Set? I thought we had one more page. Yeah, additional bonds test. This is the last, I probably bored you enough, but this is the last item. And this is a protection for somebody who's already bought bonds. And that is, on what circumstances can you issue more bonds and therefore dilute my interest as an individual bondholder? In what situations can you dilute the interest that I have by selling more bonds that have the same priority of claim against these revenues? And it all goes back to the same thing we've talked about in a couple of contexts, coverage. You have to have a certain level of coverage. And normally, if you're talking about, again, I've used 150 as a general example. If you have a structure that requires 1.50 times coverage, 150% coverage, normally the additional bonds test will say, after I issue the new debt, I need to be, you, the issuer, need to be in a position where you can demonstrate, either through historical revenues or through a new feasibility test, you can demonstrate that the new revenues, after you're done and after you have the new debt service in place, will cover that maximum debt service by at least 150%, so that an existing bondholder has some comfort that they won't have their interest diluted down to where it's no longer the same credit quality they had to begin with.
I can't imagine that happening. I can't imagine the primary bondholders not wanting the subsequent bondholders to subordinate. Why would they do that?
It is very standard. When you sell airport revenue bonds, I don't know the exact test, but you've sold a number of series of airport revenue bonds, one after the other, and just because you do new improvements. And those first bondholders have an agreement that so long as you have the coverage, as long as you have coverage, in order to make sure that you maintain the minimum ratio, you can sell more bonds.
And everybody's pari passu.
Right. Yep. Right. Now, there are some structures, and I think Orange County does have structures that are a subordinate lien, but it isn't like I issue the first bonds on one lien and the next bonds and the lower lien and the next bonds and lower lien. There are different levels, and you access them depending on what your revenue expectations are and what your needs are.
I didn't realize that happened. I didn't know that.
Yes, it does with airports.
Yeah.
But it also occurs in most of the revenue settings we do. Sales tax revenue bonds. OCTA does that on their sales tax revenue bonds. The water and sewer revenue bonds all have that kind of protection as well. Huh. But buyers do accept that kind of potential dilution. And with that, you've asked a lot of questions. I'm happy to answer. Tom and I'd be happy to answer any more. I think we've run through our.
Thank you very much for your presentation. The only final question I have is, are there any revenue bonds in the county coming up that you're aware of?
Teeters.
Well, last PFAC meeting in October, your committee approved in concept the potential Dana Point Harbor.
Sure.
And OC Parks. And in the case of the parks, that was a discrete, specific revenue source that's now contributes to the bankruptcy refinancing bonds, which will drop off in 2017.
17, I think.
Yeah. So that's one example.
Well, we have Teeters. Teeters are revenue bonds.
Teeter has pledged revenue, the delinquent base tax
that comes
that's collected.
Every year.
that comes up every year, and that is pledged specifically to the repayment of the commercial paper principal.
Okay. Is there anything, just not only get running late here, but is there anything new on the harbor thing that's since the last time we talked about it?
At the board meeting on Tuesday, there was a supplemental EIR. I didn't get to listen to the whole board meeting, but the Board of Supervisors approved a supplemental EIR that was presented. In January, I think the team is going to get together for an introductory meeting.
The 7th, the EIR, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Do we have any more questions for these people? Mr. DeMars, Mr. Wiles, I want to thank you very much. It was very helpful, and I appreciate you doing that. Any other things you'd like to add? Does anybody from the public like to have any comments? If not, this meeting is adjourned.